Iran rejects claims about granting the International Atomic Energy Agency access to individuals as part of its inspections of the country's nuclear program. Political tensions are escalating in Tunisia as opposition supporters rally against President Kais Saied's policies despite an official ban on their protest. And China announces a rise in its annual military budget amid growing tensions between Beijing and Washington over a wide range of issues. Our top story this hour, Iran has rejected claims about granting the International Atomic Energy Agency access to individuals as part of its inspections of the country's nuclear program. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the issue was not even raised during the visit by the IAEA chief Rafael Grossi to Tehran. Behruz Kamalvandi added that there was also no discussion about unrestricted access to the alleged three undeclared locations where the agency claims to have found uranium traces. He also stressed that Iran's agreement with the IAEA during Grossi's visit complies with a law passed by the Iranian parliament to counter sanctions and develop the country's nuclear program. As part of the agreement, Iran said it will voluntarily allow the agency to conduct more verification and monitoring activities in case such activities are needed. After arriving in Vienna, Grossi claimed that the agreement includes access to people of interest.
The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has said that there is, quote, great expectations about his ongoing talks with Iranian officials over issues concerning their cooperation. The remarks sent a positive signal on the course of cooperation between the agency and Tehran. That positive assessment was also echoed by Mohammad Islami, head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization.
The Islamic Republic will in no way compromise on its national interests and its national security. These meetings show Tehran and the IAEA maintain a professional relationship based on trust, and that we attach great importance to abiding by the IAEA safeguards.
Islami added that IAEA reports have confirmed that Iran has not enriched uranium beyond 60% and that issues regarding claims that some uranium particles have been found in undeclared sites in Iran have been resolved. Grossi, for his part, said that the discussions are being held in an atmosphere of honesty and cooperation. He insisted that the agency is not a political tool for any country.
IAEA has not been and will never be a political tool of anybody. I, as Director General, I am independent. I am under no country's instructions. And we act in a way that is very transparent. Member states have a board of governors. Every step we take is scrutinized. And I think that what is important is to work together, as the Vice President was saying, work on the cooperation, which is very important, on peaceful uses, work on the observance of the comprehensive safeguard agreements, and all the rest is speculation.
Grossi was also asked by reporters present in the presser to comment on the Israeli regime's total lack of accountability regarding its nuclear weapons program. Grossi said that there are limitations to the agency's inspections of those that have not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
That being said, let me conclude this important question by saying that every country in the world should be party, should be a member of the non-proliferation treaty.
The visit appears to have helped improve relations between Iran and the IAEA, particularly scientific and technical collaboration between them. The two officials said that Iran's annual nuclear science conference, which has so far been held on a national level, will be upgraded to an international conference from next year.
Both sides have expressed satisfaction with the talks, and Mr. Grossi himself has called the atmosphere positive, which could pave the way for the revival of the nuclear deal. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Now, opposition supporters in Tunisia have taken to the streets in defiance of an official ban on demonstrations against President Kais Saied. The protesters broke through a police barrier in the capital Tunis to rally in the city's main streets. Police had already warned them that their demonstration was illegal, but added that they would not stop them by force. The demonstrators were demanding President Saied step down. The rally came after some opposition leaders were recently arrested as part of a crackdown on prominent critics of Saied. They have been charged with conspiring against state security. It's time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. More than 200,000 people rally across Israel for the ninth straight week against the policies of the new Israeli far-right cabinet. The protests turned violent in Tel Aviv. Israeli forces fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse the demonstrators. They also blocked some streets in an attempt to contain the rally. The protesters are angry at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. If approved, the legislation would increase the cabinet's influence in choosing judges and limit the powers of the Supreme Court to overturn the cabinet's decisions. Critics argue that the legal changes will foster corruption and bring diplomatic isolation. The reforms are the cornerstone of Netanyahu's cabinet, an alliance of ultra-Orthodox and extreme right-wing parties which took office in late December. Joining us for more on that is Moti Abu Musaba, a Palestinian political activist in Gaza City from the besieged Gaza Strip, and also Mick Napier, from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh in Scotland. Gentlemen, welcome. Moti, if I could start with you, in your opinion, where can this unrest by the protesters, or the settlers to be more precise, lead to, in your opinion?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. It has become a matter of fact that the Israeli occupation nowadays is experiencing a severe political deadlock, which is emerging with having this kind of Israeli far-right government and authority and office. A major part of this problem and this crisis actually refers to that many of the Israeli ministers engaged and involved in this Israeli government have a corruption crisis against them in the Israeli courts. So from their point of view, having any kind of reforms in the judiciary system, actually, would enable them to evade any kind of accountability or any kind of sentences regarding those corruption files and cases. So we are in front of an emerging crisis inside the Israeli occupation. Part of this crisis, actually, refers to the personal interest of those Israeli ministers. And this is actually a tiny part of the adverse consequences that this Israeli government, far-right government, has these kind of ramifications and consequences are not about the Palestinian people only. It would actually touch also the Israeli occupation itself. Because the tendency of this far-right government is to occupy and to overwhelm the decision-making and to avoid any kind of responsibility, which means that they would go beyond any kind of limitations, any kind of borders in order to perform and to implement their racist agendas, mainly against the Palestinian people.
Right. Mick, what's your take on all this? The president of the Zionist entity has warned that the regime is on the brink of collapse, social collapse, and possibly faces a violent collision.
Well, commentators over the years and over the decades have often pointed out that if the Israelis, if the Zionist bloc wasn't determined to crush the Palestinians and didn't have a so-called enemy in the Palestinians, then there would always be the danger of a civil war. Look, when you've invited me on before to your program to comment on events, I have to say I often had difficulty in thinking of what to say, because week after week and month after month, we saw the same thing. We saw killings, we saw occasional massacres, we saw full spectrum criminality against the Palestinians. And the Israeli Supreme Court made this possible. The Israeli Supreme Court is being portrayed by the demonstrators and by pro-Israel elements in Britain and America as a bastion of democracy. But it was the Israeli Supreme Court that legitimized torture, legitimized house demolitions, collective punishment, all sorts of crimes, shoot to kill, and so on. So from the point of view of the Palestinian people, this is a demonstration within the Zionist bloc, and it's a demonstration by people who support Jewish supremacy but don't want to see a dictatorship by Netanyahu over Jews. So people talk about what's going on in Palestine, Israel at the moment as the appearance of fascism, as the appearance of a democracy. For Palestinians, this is absurd. They have always lived under a dictatorship. But for some sections of Jews, they are afraid that perhaps just a little bit of what's been dealt out to the Palestinians might be dealt out to them. The loss of civil liberties. I think it's Ben-Gvir, who's the police minister, or Smotrich, I'm sorry if I've got that wrong. But somebody like him in charge of the police will not stop at the massacre of Palestinians, but will commit abuses against dissident Jews. So somebody, a famous German sociologist once said, a nation that oppresses another can never be free itself. And the Zionists have been oppressing the Palestinians so long, they have incubated a monstrous regime in the course of doing that, and now that monstrous regime threatens to devour some of its own. But you know, the United States, the United Arab Emirates, the UK, these governments have made all of this possible. They have defended the Israeli regime in its full spectrum criminality. And in Britain, certainly, and in America, they have attacked anybody who dared to say that there was something terribly wrong about this regime. But now we can see that it's a dictatorship, it's a brutal ethnic cleansing operation against Palestinians, but now it's threatening to devour its own. That's what's at stake, as far as the demonstrators are concerned. But they will never appeal to the Palestinians to support them, to fight for human rights for all. And I think because of that, they are doomed. I suspect Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich will succeed in crushing this liberal opposition among the Zionists. And then Israel is a danger to all the people of the region with its hundreds of nuclear weapons. And we all have an interest in what's going on at the moment inside it. Something new is happening, but precisely what it is, people need to understand. It's a civil war among Zionist Jews as to the best way to oppress and expel the Palestinians.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. The very interesting points raised. Let me thank our guest. Matiya Abu Musaba is a Palestinian political activist joining us from Gaza City in the besieged of the Gaza Strip. And Mick Napier, thank you very much, as always. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign from lovely Edinburgh. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review. Moving on now, China's military budget has risen by 7.2% this year, slightly outpacing last year's increase. The national budget released on Sunday showed some $224 billion has been allocated to military spending for the year 2023. Beijing says armed forces should work to carry out military operations, boost combat preparedness and enhance their military capabilities. This year's hike in defense spending marks the 8th consecutive single-digit increase. The upswing in the defense budget comes amid growing tensions between Beijing and Washington over a wide range of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Political analyst Angelo Giuliano says China's increase in defense spending is quite rational, given the rise in the defense budgets of Japan and the U.S., both Taiwan's allies.
I think this increase is a non-issue. Just to remind you, there's the GDP increase for 2023 will be 6%. So now you have, in comparison, you have a 7.2% of increase for defense spending. I think it is marginal. What worries me more is actually what Japan is doing. Japan is aiming to spend double what it is spending right now in defense spending by 2027. That is a much more relevant news, especially since Japan is positioning itself to be extremely aggressive. Japan declared that what Japan did was to reinterpret the Pacific Constitution. Additional to that, they say that if Taiwan was to be attacked, well, Taiwan as an ally would be defended. So I think that is the real news. When it comes to defense spending, I think China is very very rational. I think also you need to compare to the U.S. Right now, China is spending one quarter of what the U.S. is spending. If you were to adjust this into power parity, purchase power parity, it would be about half what the U.S. is spending.
Chaotic scenes in Peru as police and anti-government protesters clash in the capital, Lima. The protesters are calling for early elections and the resignation of President Dina Boluarte. They are also demanding the release of ousted President Pedro Castillo. The rallies began in December after then-President Pedro Castillo was forced out of office and was replaced by his vice president, Dina Boluarte. The protesters want Castillo to be freed. He's now in pretrial detention for attempting to close Congress to avoid an impeachment. Dozens of people have been killed during the months-long protests. And that report wraps up World News for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remaining vestige of God on earth. I'm very happy and thankful to God that after a relatively long break, I have the honor to see you young graduates again in a face-to-face meeting on this day this year. It is good to hear that several thousand young people have joined the armed forces, and this happens every year, whether it is young university graduates who have earned the rank of officer and enter the workforce, or those who enter the university, receive a shoulder mark and a study. Both of them inject a new spirit into the armed forces in a certain way. Both of these groups of young people bring a message of renewal and stability. Whenever young people enter a place, whenever they join an association or an organization, they actually bring the message of strength and renewal to that place.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The presence of the Iranian youth in all fields is promising. So whenever they enter various fields, such as the scientific, economic, political, organizational, and military sectors, they bring with them the positive message of hope, renewal, and innovation. Today, there is a misleading propaganda campaign going on that tries to show the opposite of this. The aim of this propaganda is to imply that the Iranian youth have lost their values, have no hope for the future, and do not feel they have any sort of responsibility. There is a propaganda campaign that is serious pursuing this goal, but the reality of the matter is the opposite of this. What is happening in our country is the exact opposite. Our younger generation has progressed brilliantly in all fields and arenas up until today. God willing, they will continue to do the same in the future. Whether it is to defend their homeland, to preserve security, or to help the resistance front throughout their entire region.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Israeli regime is stepping up its violent and racist policies against Palestinians. On Thursday, a young Palestinian man succumbed to his injuries that he recently sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, also known as Ariha. 22-year-old Mahmoud Jamal Hamdan was critically wounded during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp. On Wednesday, Israeli troops stormed the Aqaba Jab refugee camp following a shooting attack on a highway outside of Jericho that left one Israeli soldier dead. During the raid, the regime's forces sealed off the camp and prevented ambulances and journalists from entering it. They also fatally wounded Hamdan, whom they accused of being involved in the attack. Regime atrocities come against the backdrop of increasing settler violence against Palestinians. On Sunday night, hundreds of armed Israeli settlers, flanked by soldiers, attacked Palestinian villages near the West Bank town of Hawara and set fire to homes, storefronts, and cars.
I was here yesterday when the incident occurred. I didn't know how to escape, as they closed immediately all roads and exits. So I was obliged to stay here. I locked the door, and after that the settlers came to burn things. They set fire to all the wood I had, the car, and they burnt the area.
At least one Palestinian was killed and nearly 400 were wounded in the hours-long rampage, which was denounced by Israeli rights group Peace Now and B'Tselem as a settler pogrom supported by the occupying regime. Palestinian officials have called on the U.S. Security Council to ensure protection for Palestinians who have increasingly come under deadly attacks by Israeli forces and settlers.
What we have seen here in this house is evidence of how big the crime carried out by the settlers and covered by army and protected by the army is. It is clear that this move is supported by a political decision from the Israeli cabinet. Therefore, three sides are partners in this crime. The cabinet, which takes the political decision, the army, which is protecting the settlers, and the settlers who are implementing. This is what we have seen here.
The Arab League has also said that it fully holds the far-right Israeli administration, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, responsible for the systematic crimes committed by extremist settlers. After they went on a violent rampage in the West Bank, Israeli forces have killed nearly 70 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. On Tuesday, the Israeli Knesset approved a bill authorizing the execution of Palestinian detainees, conduct anti-occupation operations. Hamas resistance movement has strongly condemned the bill, noting that the move reflects the regime's, quote, fascist tendencies. Hamas has stressed that such policies and laws will not deter the Palestinian people from continuing their legitimate resistance against the Israeli occupation. Furthermore, on Wednesday, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who is an ultra-nationalist in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition, said that the Palestinian village of Hawara should be wiped out.
All over Israel, here in Tel Aviv and elsewhere, we are protesting against the horrific pogrom committed by the extremist settlers in the West Bank yesterday. They came because they have the support of the government. They have the support of high-ranking Kahanist ministers serving in the government, and they are deepening the occupation, deepening the bloodshed.
So we are here tonight to demonstrate after the settlers in Hawara attacked and burned the village and the people who live in Hawara, the Palestinian people. And we are here to demonstrate to stop the occupation.
Even the U.S. administration, which is Tel Aviv's staunch ally, has called the remarks repugnant. Attacks against Palestinians have escalated since late December 2022, when Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power as prime minister of the occupying regime's most far-right cabinet ever. Netanyahu is now under mounting pressure. Streets across the occupied territories have witnessed mass protests since Netanyahu's controversial move to reform the judiciary. Opponents argue that the legal changes threaten the independence of judges and weaken oversight of the ruling cabinet and parliament. They say the plan will undermine the rights of minorities and would open the door to more corruption. But Netanyahu, who is on trial for corruption, says the changes will boost business. There are now threats that his coalition cabinet will break up due to internal differences and mass protests.
A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Instead of supporting dialogue and a peaceful resolution, the West, particularly the US, have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine. This trend has only further escalated the conflict. Last week, Beijing called for a comprehensive ceasefire as it released a peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. The document, which covers 12 aspects, adheres to the principle of respecting the sovereignty of both countries. It calls for resuming peace talks and promotes the post-conflict reconstruction in the long run. Beijing also demanded an end to unilateral sanctions on Russia and criticized NATO expansion, saying the US and NATO are fanning the flames and adding fuel to the fire, and they are the culprit and pusher of the crisis. China also made clear its opposition to not only the use of nuclear weapons, but the threat of deploying them, saying nuclear weapons must not be used and nuclear wars must not be fought. In addition, China also called for efforts to set up humanitarian corridors for the evacuation of civilians from conflict zones, to protect civilians and prisoners of war, and to facilitate grain exports. China has sought to position itself as a neutral party in the conflict and play the role of a mediator. Meanwhile, Russia said it has paid a lot of attention to the plan by China, but the conditions for a peaceful resolution of the conflict were not in place. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "For now, we don't see any of the conditions that are needed to bring this whole story towards peace." Moscow had said that any settlement of the conflict needed to recognize Russia's control over four Ukrainian regions it annexed last year. It also wants Ukraine to renounce its bid to join NATO. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country needed to work with China, arguing it seems that there is a respect for Ukraine's territorial integrity and security issues in the Chinese perspective. However, Kyiv said that it will not agree to any peace without the return of all its territory. The publication of the proposal follows accusations from the West that China is considering arming Russia, a claim Beijing has dismissed as false information. Ukraine's head of military intelligence has brushed aside claims that China is considering sending arms to Russia. Kirill Budanov told US media that he saw no signs that such things are even being discussed. That's after senior US officials said that they were confident China was considering providing lethal equipment to Moscow. Earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken aired Washington's concerns about potential arms shipments in a tense meeting with his Chinese counterpart. Also, the director of the CIA, William Burns, said in an interview on Sunday that he believed Beijing was still weighing the possibility. Asked specifically about the U.S. assessment, Budanov said, "I am the head of intelligence and I rely with all due respect not on the opinions of individual people, but only on facts. I do not see such facts." China says it has kept contact with all sides in the crisis, including Kyiv, and its position was clear. The core is to call for peace and promote dialogue and promote a political solution to the crisis. China has warned that the war in Ukraine is getting out of control. Beijing has urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire, saying it's deeply concerned about the situation. Beijing rejected the US and NATO claims as false and said it is the US that is endlessly sending arms to Ukraine, not China. The US and NATO have been warning China against sending weapons to Russia, while they have been providing Ukraine with billions of dollars in arms and military aid since the beginning of the war a year ago.
The US desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of the special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even lauded the growing economic partnership between the two countries, along with political, economic, social, defense, and security cooperation. Lavrov's successful visit to the continent and planned Russia-Africa summit and economic forum in July are testimonies that West, the U.S. in particular, have failed in their plots to isolate Russia internationally. A visit by the Russian diplomat to South Africa refurbished the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security and promoting global development and prosperity. With South Africa hosting the Summit of Five Emerging Economies, commonly known as BRICS, this year, the ruling African National Congress has suggested that Pretoria could use the chairmanship to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge a global arrogance. In the words of Pandor herself, "The current global geopolitical tensions clearly signal the need to create institutional mechanisms that will have the stature from the global trust to promote and support global peace and security. BRICS should play a proactive role in emerging processes and ensure it is part of a redesigned global order." Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. Pandor argued that hosting such maneuvers with what she called friends were part of the natural course of relations. Nevertheless, the popular resentment against the West, the US, the UK, and France in particular, are on the rise due to their historic oppression on the continent. Anti-West sentiment could be clearly seen in nationwide protests in Burkina Faso, with demonstrators condemning former colonizer France while waving Russian flags. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. At this moment, the unity is an anti-colonial power structure seemed to be of high urgency for African nations. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangement is another need, especially for East African countries that are embroiled in power politics. These could uplift not only the continental stature, but a unified power to reckon with. However, this major paradigm shift can be duly achievable if countries across the African continent come together and stand firm against the West imperialism. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has announced the operation of a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers. Speaking at a televised program, commander of the IRGC Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amirali Hajizadeh, said the new long-range missile is codenamed Pave. The commander said this was to honor the Iranian forces martyred in the Khorasan province. The brigadier general noted that all of Iran's missiles are now manufactured with precision-guided accuracy, adding that all American bases in the region are within the reach of the Iranian missiles. Hajizadeh said, "We are now capable of targeting American aircraft carriers at a 2,000-kilometer distance." He noted that the U.S.'s superiority has been shaking after Iran developed its new hypersonic missile, which can maneuver outside the Earth's atmosphere and defeat all anti-missile defense systems. In a stern warning also to Europe, the Iranian commander said, "Of course, we have kept the distance at 2,000 kilometers out of respect for the Europeans," adding, "We hope that Europeans would preserve their dignity." The remarks by the Iranian commander came at a time when Europe has done its share of trying to antagonize Iran by closely aligning its Tehran policies with those of the U.S. After all, the European countries, namely France, Germany, and the U.K., have been maintaining a hostile posture toward Iran's defensive missile and peaceful nuclear programs. The EU has also challenged Tehran's regional influence and cooperated with Washington in its anti-Iran sanctions. Needless to say that last month, the European Parliament approved an amendment calling on the European Union and its member states to include the IRGC on their terror list. The resolution drew strong reaction from Iran. IRGC's chief commander, Major General Hossein Salami, warned that the Europeans would suffer the consequences of the move. The 27-nation bloc has also been slapping more sanctions on Iran over what it calls the country's approach toward foreign-backed riots that erupted in some Iranian cities in September. The recent IRGC announcement comes as the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on the country's military to increase its efforts to attract, nurture, and train capable Iranians in line with the Islamic Revolution military doctrine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on the IRGC to use its full capabilities to be able to protect the revolution and to strengthen the IRGC's spiritual and military foundations. This can be clearly highlighted in General Hajizadeh's comments when he addressed the issue of Iran's growing missile power. He has enumerated features of the country's hypersonic missile that was manufactured late last year and announced a new cruise missile's inclusion in the list of IRGC's military hardware. This brings to the spotlight the military might of the Islamic Republic, which includes capabilities of Iran's army with its latest underground base for fighter jets and more particularly the country's missile power in the face of the West's threats. That comprises threats coming from Israel, with the regime targeting several military sites in the city of Isfahan lately. While U.S.'s benefit lies in creating regional insecurity, as General Hajizadeh put it, there needs to be a military power in the region to deter such threats. Tehran believes that Washington is a root cause of almost all global conflicts, including the war in Ukraine. The Islamic Republic argues that the West Asia region sits on a security fault line, given the history of conflicts in the past four decades. Another factor that Tehran has always highlighted is the need to maintain the country's military might. It says if it fails to be strong, the enemy will bring the war inside Iran. That's why Iranian military commanders urge and advise Iranian armed forces to meet the security needs of the nation. Given all the threats posed by the U.S. and its allies, the Corps has always been aiming to render the American war machine ineffective and thus has managed to bring all the U.S.'s regional bases within the range of its defensive firepower. They have also turned Washington bases in the region into its weak spots, with the IRGC having the ability to strike U.S. outposts whenever the need arises. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to the Youth Station. I'm your host, Zainab Askari, and today I have had the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, Sister Zainab?
Alhamdulillah, I'm fine. How are you, brother?
Alhamdulillah, not bad. Our topic is interesting. The birth anniversary of Ali Akbar, the son of Imam Hussein.
It is indeed. So before we get into the topic, I am staying with you for the first time, Brother Muhammad.
Yeah, I'm Muhammad, as you know.
Yeah.
And I'm from South America, and I study in the Hausa at the moment. And yeah, it's basically the summary of my life, essentially, yeah.
So when did you actually come to Hausa?
It's been around 6 years now.
All right.
I've been in Iran for 6 years at least now, and it's been a great experience so far. Yeah.
Nice. Well, I'm Zainab Askari, and I come from Kashmir.
Great.
Which is administrated, and...
Unfortunately, should I say. Or yeah. Fortunately.
No, we also consider that unfortunate. And I have also been in Hausa for some 8 years now. Actually, I have been in Iran for some 8 years. First of all, I actually congratulate you on the very auspicious occasion.
Thank you very much. Congratulations to you and all the listeners.
Yeah, thank you.
On the occasion of the birth anniversary of Ali Akbar, the son of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Known as the Youth Day over here.
Yeah, that's...
And that's what I got to know for the first time when I was in Hausa. And all these ladies around in the administration, they gathered us in the prayer room.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us we have something special for you. And there were beautiful red roses, fresh. And they called us one by one and they started giving us the red roses. And I was amazed to see that. I have never seen that before in my life. Like a woman giving roses to women and then congratulating on some special
thing. Exactly. A while ago, we had an episode, I think, with Brother Muzaffar. And he was talking about the environment and how culture affects a person. I think this is one of the great benefits of being in an Islamic country. Then the culture around you, for example, Women's Day is going to be the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima. Father's Day is going to be the birth anniversary of Imam Ali. The Youth Day is going to be the birth anniversary of Ali Akbar. And these occasions, and when they're kind of combined with the kind of the things that we have today, like Youth Day and Women's Day and so on, it gives you a very good culture of, you know, an Islamic culture. It gives
exactly.
you a good, great feeling.
Like I had been all my life celebrating the Women's Day, rather anchoring on the program for the programs of Women's
exactly.
Day. On 8th of March, which is considered to be the International Women's Day.
Yeah.
But then when I got to know that Women's Day in Iran is different, and I couldn't deny that. But in India...
It gives some spirit into it,
yeah.
right? Because having an 8th of... What is it in 8th of
like
March? There's nothing
the
special
The thing that was
in
into my head that time was, what else could be the better day than this
Exactly,
day?
Exactly. So yeah, these are the benefits of being in an Islamic country. You have a very great culture. Let's talk about some of the characteristics of Ali Akbar, this great... personality. I think what we must shed light on is the role models youth choose to be today, especially in
That's
the modern
the
world.
That's the most important topic we can talk on.
Yeah, yeah. So in the modern world, you see people, especially youths, they end up choosing role models, whether it be in reality or fantasies, but they're not necessarily role models that are going to give them success. People like, you know...
So what are the criteria, as per you, that the youth today goes and chooses a role model?
To me, I think, first of all, how I would personally perceive this is taking that criteria, as the Quran says, Uswatun Hasana, the Prophet is your Uswa Hasana, the best role model, yeah. Right? I'll take that as the main criteria, and I'll see who is the most closest to the Prophet in my day and age to see, and I'll make that person as my role model. Right, I'll find all the characteristics of the person who is closest to the Prophet, and I'll make that person as a role model. But then the youths today, that's not how, unfortunately, many of them see it.
Well, I know that this criteria has definitely come into your mind.
Yeah.
Out here in Hausa. But what was before that? I would like to ask.
I had a religious background, so even before Hausa,
so it was lucky. So before we get into it, let's have a sip of water. What would you say?
Let's take a break and we'll be back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Okay, so we're back to our youth station, and we're talking about Ali Akbar and the role models. We touched upon role models. My say about role models is, unfortunately, considering the recent media boost, or the media, I should rather say, revolution, we find so much of fantasies in movies and cartoons and so on. People considered, and this is an actual thing, like in the first or the second year of my house, I can remember some of my colleagues, they were discussing about who is better, Batman or Superman, and they would really fight about it. It's not like, you know, you sit down and you discuss and it's a very, you know, it wasn't a healthy conversation, like, oh, Batman can do this, Superman can do that. And you'd be surprised, these people are coming to the house, we're doing
well in India as well. We have the Bollywood culture, and unfortunately,
exactly,
in that culture you pick up randomly the role models for yourself,
yeah.
And even I remember
myself. And they keep calling themselves the names, like, I'm Superman, I'm Batman, I'm that, I'm this. And these are all fantasies. They don't even exist, right?
Yeah.
This is like the most extreme, the worst a person can be, because you're kind of taking characteristics. You're taking people, you're taking role models from things that don't exist. Like, that's not possible. Like, if a person can fly over the air without wings, how do you want to be like that? Like, it's just movies, it's just CGI animation and so on.
Yeah.
But then the better, maybe you can say the better, one step better to that, but even though it's still not the best, is taking role models, taking, you know, actors and actresses, or, you know, footballers and so on as role models.
Like, yeah,
have you seen how many youths do you see recently after the FIFA World Cup? They try to dress like those footballers. They try to make their hairstyles like those.
You wouldn't believe, you have one of the examples right here in the studio in front of you. When I was young, I literally went out and brought a poster of an actress which I liked a lot, just because she had two dimples on her two sides and she was so beautiful. This was my criteria, you know, like the body image. And in today's world, the social media, what it's doing, it's actually promoting that body image. Yes, this is something that should be. And, you know, you see married women, you see anyone, you see young girls, you see anyone, they want to be like that. What the body image is being presented on the social media, what is being highlighted today. But then I literally had a poster in one of my rooms, and whenever my uncle would come and wanted to have prayers in that room, he used to pick that up and throw it out in the dustbin, and I would bring it back. I would pray
from the dustbin.
So I was like so diehard fan of that woman, just because of her dimples.
Have you changed since, or do you still like the dimples?
She is like that. They become younger day by day.
No,
I don't
yourself,
know how.
Have you changed since, or do you still consider that
course,
person as
of
a role
course.
Model?
Of course. Actually, before the moment I get back here, I got to, when I faced the realities of life, then I got to know not everything that shines is gold.
Mm-hmm.
There's something behind that, and life is all about challenges. It's all about patience you have to face. And then when I came to Iran, actually, my eyes opened much wider.
Exactly.
So I had much.
You know, the challenges we face today with the youth is that when you try to give them this example, say, for example, Prophet is the best role model, or the children of the Prophets are the best role models, Imam Hussein, Imam Hassan are the best role models, they don't develop that connection. Right? Why? I think it's mainly because a great time has passed from the time that they've lived. Let's take a break and we'll discuss this after the break.
Sure. Welcome back. You're listening to the Youth Station. I'm Zainab. I'm with Brother Muhammad, and it's a great experience to be with him today. And Brother Muhammad and your listeners, once again, we wish you the birth anniversary of Ali Akbar, which is also considered as a youth day. So happy youth day to you.
Thank you very much,
Brother Muhammad.
Thank you very much, you as well. So we're discussing about this age gap that we have with these role models, with the Prophet and his progeny, his pure progeny, and why some of the youths, or I should say rather many of the youths, they don't consider them as role models. What do you think? What is your take? Do you think we can still consider them as role models?
Indeed, of course we can. Actually, we also had some of that stuff in our heads, like, all right, our parents used to tell us, make them as your role model. So we had something in our head. Some people who have lived some 1400 years ago, how can they be the role models for us today?
Is it even possible?
So yeah, we even used to tell our parents that you don't know many things that we know today. So how are you going to be our role model? So someone who has lived some 1400 years back. When I came actually here, and then I got to know about the life, and I was very much touched by Lady Zainab Salamu Alaiha's patience. So one thing that actually striked my head, that shaked me, was her patience. So I was like, my father was right. Patience has never changed. Patience was then and patience is now. Her good deeds were then and good deeds are now. The way Ali Akbar's day is today, the way he sacrificed his life, the way he was obedient to his father, the way he was obedient to Islam, that obedience is still alive. That obedience is not, time cannot kill that obedience, the patience, the good deeds they have been doing and
that's
teaching
true.
Us.
You see, living in the West, what happens is that you get so materialized that you want to have a material example of everything. So that's no exception for role models. So when we say role models and we bring role models that are like not in our time, what happens is you don't develop that connection because your mind is kind of material and you want to make sure you see that role model before you consider him as a role model. But then after coming back here to Iran, like as you mentioned, the revolutions happen, yeah? And we see people, we see the ulama, because it's tough for you to imagine a person being infallible. You can't say, okay, I'm going to try my best to be infallible. You can't. It's just tough, right? You have to do so much muraqabah. You have to stay away from sins. You have to do all the good deeds. You have to go through struggles and struggles and struggles. You wouldn't find anybody going through those things. Or you hardly find someone going through a percentage of that in the West. But then when you come to the Islamic country, then you realize, oh my God, there's so many people. There's so many mujtahid. There's so many urafa. There's so many mystics that are going through this on a daily basis, and their names are not mentioned in the media, they're not mentioned anywhere in the world.
Really?
They're so miraculous, and they've reached a standard. That's when you get that hope. Oh, it's possible. I can.
You know, I remember I was staying in Dua-e Komel once in the Haram, and the speaker was saying that now take up your hands so that when we take up our hands for Dua, maybe our duas get answered. And the lady staying next to me held my hand.
Yeah.
And she was so pious, like from the beginning I had
so
been
beautiful.
Seeing her to the end. And then I was like, oh my God. Someone who has much more.
Yeah, the connection took its place, yeah?
Yeah, so someone who has been doing, as per you, what you mentioned, as muraqabah than me.
Yeah.
And now so down to earth is holding my hand. and then making the dua. So this is what should be the criteria.
The possibility exists as once you see that people in this day and age do exist who try to make these people as role models and who follow their footsteps. And it's completely possible. It's just that you have to have that
so
willpower.
In the beginning, brother, I became a fan of these ladies around me when I saw them, be that in my university, be that around, be that